Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here today and present our budget as well as give you a little bit of information about where we are as a new agency, newly reorganized on July 1st. It's been a very busy year with the organization happening, reorganization happening really within a six-month period. We went live under the new name of Department of Workforce Services on July 1st. I think it really speaks to the character of all of the staff in both agencies that we were able to do this without any additional resources. We've worked on changing signage, cards, stationery, letterheads, forms, all of that without any additional appropriations or any ask for expenditures, and it's been a great effort. It's been pretty grassroots within the agency. We've sought out input from any staff that wanted to participate in having input on how the new agency should look, how we should interact with ourselves inside that agency, and how we should interact with our constituents externally. We have set six values for ourselves within the agency, the first one being customer service, and that is really, there's no giving on that, both internally and externally. Not saying that it's perfect, but it is the expectation that we respond to each other and to the people outside the agency. And, of course, that isn't a perfect system, but we're working to get there, and I would hope that you would give me the opportunity to address anything that you're encountering that doesn't align with that. I'd like to introduce our staff that's here with us today. To my right is Deputy Director Lisa Oswald. Behind us we have John Eisbart, who is the administrator over our standards and compliance side of the programs, and you can refer to our organizational chart on page 12. Probably you'll want to do that several times throughout the conversation just to kind of see how we're organized and set up, and that really does go to a lot of our programs and thought process. We also have Toby Wickham, who is the administrator over our workforce program side. Again, referring to the org chart, you can kind of see how that is. Bob Curtis, fiscal administrator from former Department of Employment. He's the fiscal administrator over the workforce standards and compliance side of our programs. Angie Buchanan is not with us today. She's the fiscal administrator over workforce programs, and she was called away on an emergency right before we came over. And we have Mike Todd, policy analyst from the former Department of Employment, and Lynn Welker, who serves three roles in our agency. She used to handle the policy issues for former workforce services. She still does policy. She's also the administrator for the Workforce Development Council, and she's the administrator over the Workforce Development Training Fund programs. So it's a pleasure to have them here, and we may need to refer to them if we have questions. So customer service being the main value that we focus on, both externally and internally, collaboration, communication, trusted honesty, professional development and empowerment, and respect. And these values came from our staff and have been adopted by our staff. The org structure, again, is on page 12 of the book, really organized around how we felt constituents access our services. The biggest change with the reorganization is having the Division of Unemployment Insurance interact with our Employment and Training Division. That ties directly to reemployment efforts, and it gives us a better opportunity to track those who are on unemployment insurance benefits and be sure that we're working with them diligently to get them a job. We've reorganized the agency into many teams that work together that are cross-agency teams. This was a painful process at first, folks saying, I can't do that, I'm not allowed to, my program requirements say I can't, and we just kept saying, let's just give it a try. For instance, our quality assurance team that you see on the left-hand side of the org chart, it's a group of individuals who had quality assurance responsibilities in different divisions and programs in the agency, but now they work together as one team to share best practices, fill in for each other, and develop some standards for quality assurance across the agency. I actually have a team of individuals reporting to me now that include policy, grants, labor market information. Many of you know Tom Gallagher from CASPER that heads up research and planning. He now reports directly to me so that we can use the labor market information in a more strategic way. And we do ask anyone who is in charge of staff or a team to be meeting with them at least once a week. And so we have some very lively policy team meetings where we talk about big picture type things. Lisa Oswald, our deputy director, again, over all the operational aspect of the agency, human resources, fiscal, IT, marketing, and then we also do have the state mine inspector that reports to the agency. He is actually appointed by the governor, so that's a little bit of a unique relationship there. Working continually to find efficiencies to coordinate our services. For example, now we have a new procedure within the agency where if an employer needs to change something with their tax account and their workers' comp account, they can call one person rather than both divisions to get that done. That's, again, a work in progress, and we hope that continues to become more smoothly over time. Lisa Oswald also handles all of our constituent complaints, whether they come from the governor or from one of you, or they just come directly to me through an email. We have a system in place where that complaint is addressed very comprehensively, not only the specific thing that they're struggling with, but then we look to see if there's other programs or services that could help them out in their situation, not only within the agency, but outside the agency. So Lisa kind of shepherds that through the agency. She sends it out to those divisions and then provides her personal contact information so that they can get back with her if they're still struggling or not getting the help that they need. Efficiencies that we found and things like our employer seminars that used to be offered by the former Department of Employment now contain information about all of the programs in the two agencies, trying to streamline the number of times and the number of ways that we contact employers so they understand it is kind of a one-stop shop. Working diligently on referrals out of the workers' comp system into vocational rehabilitation. Yes, that ability was there before, but it is now strengthened by us being together. Again, reemployment. One savings that was noticed right off the bat was our workers' comp payments that we pay in as an agency being streamlined together and putting our experience rating together. We're saving quite a bit of money on that. So that just gives you some examples of how we've set up, the progress that we've made over the year. One final thing that will go live on January 1st is the new, what we call corporate website at wyomingworkforce.org. The merging together of those two websites was a little bit more complex, and we still have to do the intranets for both of those agencies. Right now you get whether or not you type in either form or URL, you're directed to a home page that basically just redirects you to our former websites. But as of January 1st, that will be one combined site. We've been doing business testing and getting some input on how that should look.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What's the name of what's the URL for the new site when it does go live?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, it'll be wyomingworkforce.org. Would you like me to? All right. Okay. Super. Wait.
This relationship with the state mine inspector and the state mining board—that's new with this whole reorganization, right? How does that work with the Board of Mines? Participation with what the state mine inspector does and how does that fit into your agency?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, if you're talking about the gal who was here presenting right before us, we don't have as much of a relationship, but the state mining board that works with Terry Adcock, yes. It's basically kind of like a division within our agency. You know, Terry is responsible for all of the mine inspections. We have staff that are employees of the agency, and he functions pseudo as an administrator, but I have the respect that he is hired by the governor, and so we have kind of a mutual respect that we just work together on things the governor would like to see him accomplish and things that fit well within the agency. So we've developed a great relationship. We work very well together, and his staff are fully integrated into the operational side of the agency. He's on the executive leadership team along with several other individuals from the agency. All right. So we will go through the exceptions. Is that your pleasure, Mr. Chairman? Yes. Page 16 would be exception number one. And that is where we are deleting a position that was held by the former director of the Department of Employment and reverting the general funds associated with that. And also transferring a position that was previously generally funded. We had a retirement, felt that we did not need to refill what she previously did. But we're seeing a backlog in our appeals division, a very severe backlog from the economic conditions over the past couple of years. And so diverted that position over to appeals, which is federally funded. So giving back the general funds and increasing the spending authority on the federal fund side. All right, number two would be on page 31. This would be adjusting the federal fund spending authority down to what we are actually receiving, both on the what we call Wagner-Peiser programs. Those are the core services that we offer in our workforce centers, and WIA, which is Workforce Investment Act, for training and supportive services for participants that meet the qualification for those programs. So that would be adjusting that down. The next item would be found on page 38. Currently, speaking of our state mine inspector, they are responsible for administering all of the recertification exams around the state each and every year, and that's currently done with paper and pencil. And during our last audit, we were cited for several errors in the grading of those exams. One of them actually impacted an individual whether he passed the exam or not, so that was pretty significant. So we're requesting to bring that into the technology age and have him be able to do that testing electronically. All right, next item on page 60 would be the increase in the federal funds for moving that position that we talked about in number one from general funds to federal funds. So that's an increase in spending authority. The next item is the system replacement for the unemployment insurance tax and benefit. If you'll recall, there was a management audit done on the unemployment insurance division in 2010, and the department has struggled for many years now with an outdated system that was developed on a mainframe legacy system, runs on COBOL programming, and is extremely outdated. So the U.S. Department of Labor has been working on what they call modernization projects now for many years. The fact that this system is not very functional impacts many areas, including the integrity of the system. So we're talking about detecting overpayments, detecting fraud, the ability to make programmatic changes if the legislature should pass some kind of a change in statute. If you might recall, last session there was a proposed bill to change who is eligible for unemployment insurance. That would have been a significant amount of reprogramming to that system because, again, we're reliant on just a couple of COBOL programmers who are retirement age and may not stick around too much longer. In 2009, the former Department of Employment used ERA funds to get into a feasibility study with three other states to talk about how this system could be replaced. They worked with Arizona, North Dakota, and Idaho. Since 2009, actually writing business use cases and getting together with that staff once a month and looking at how this system could be replaced. The tricky part has always been who would pay for it and how that would transpire. The feasibility study wound down in September, and so as it was getting close to the close of that, the Department of Labor decided to issue a guidance letter in July that allowed states to apply for money to replace these systems. And they called together the directors of those four states and said, listen, if you will meet some of our criteria, we will be more than likely prepared to fund you working together, the four of you, and then they would back the funding for the project. Idaho decided to pull out at that time because one of the requirements of the Department of Labor was that this not be an in-house build, because they've had so many failures around the country where staff kind of think, well, we can do this. We probably have the expertise in-house, and it's an overwhelming process, and it doesn't ever end up getting done. Idaho kind of had a disagreement with that. They decided to go off on their own, but however, they had been the lead state throughout the feasibility study, in other words, handling all the money, all the procurement of the vendor, and really all the housekeeping issues that went along with that. The deadline to submit the supplemental budget request to the U.S. Department of Labor was mid-August, so we had about 3 weeks to pull together a plan. Colorado reached out. They had just recently, in the past 5 to 6 years, had a failed system build where they spent a little over $50 million of state money and ended up with nothing because of some pitfalls that they really fell into with that. We originally had put ourselves out there to be the lead of the four states because Idaho was not able to do it at the time, and we had to put a lead state on the application. Since that time, we have had discussions with the governor and have decided to let Colorado take that lead if they can. So they would be the lead in all the procurement. But the U.S. Department of Labor did approve a $59 million budget request to have our four systems replaced over a three-year period. We are contributing, each state is contributing some in-kind staffing time. We had some READ Act money, that's R-E-E-D Act money, that was originally given to the agency in 2004, I believe, for unemployment insurance modernization, but it was a very small amount of money, and there was no way the agency could tackle the project at that time, so it's just been sitting there. It's been being used for reprogramming, for updates that the systems need, really patching it together since that time. That'll be part of the project. So we're looking at about a $70 million project between what the four states are contributing and what the U.S. Department of Labor is contributing. So basically, the Department of Labor has appropriated the $59 million to Wyoming because we originally said we would take lead on procurement. We just need now the spending authority to reappropriate that back out to Colorado so they can take the lead role in the project. So that's why you see a $59 million increase in spending authority in our budget. That would be on page 67, 66 and 67.
You're looking for authority to take those funds and essentially dedicate them to the Colorado project?
It would be the project with the four states, Colorado, Wyoming, North Dakota, and Idaho.
Now, I didn't understand you say, but we have...
Arizona. Excuse me.
We then have... the four systems. I didn't quite understand that. You said there was funding for replace your four systems. Is that part of the... 59?
That is the 59,
that
yes,
is the 59.
Mr. Chairman,
okay.
Yes.
So we contribute the 59 to Colorado, they'll develop their system, and then the idea is they'll come back and implement in Wyoming? I'm not quite
no.
certain.
Maybe I didn't Mr. Chairman, that. The $59 million is a federal appropriation that's come from the U.S. Department of Labor. So it's sitting there waiting for us as a four-state consortium to be able to access that. There's a very detailed plan for the four states to work together on building the four systems simultaneously. There'll be a core, a common core that's the same for all states, and then each state will build out their unique portion based on their statutes that govern their programs. But this is for the four states to use jointly together on this project over the next 3 to 4 years with very specific requirements from the Department of Labor on how that'll be spent. The majority of that will be spent on getting the expertise to build out what's needed.
I have a system that works in Wyoming.
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Right.
And what's the flexibility of it being updated when the statutes change? You said it's cumbersome with the old COBOL programming. Is this going to be a lot easier, or do we know?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, yes, the idea is that it will be built on technology that can change over the times. We had a meeting 2 weeks ago with the four directors and the four CIOs, so Flint Waters has been involved, in talking about how to approach this, whether we do a vendor build where we say build us a product that we own, or build us a product that you own so you update it and we don't end up in 15 years saying, well, we had this system 15 years ago that we can't update anymore and we don't have the expertise in-house. So try not to get back to a situation where we have these large, all at one time having to spend millions and millions of dollars to replace the system, but that it can be maintained and changed with the times.
Thank you, Joan. But Mr. Chairman, I guess a follow-up, so I've got an understanding. I know I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing. I'm talking about if we change our statutes, can it be updated? Not can you update the mainframe or the software or those things, but, I mean, like if we make twinks in the statute, how long does it take to get those implemented, those type of things, and what would be the cost of those or any idea?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, are you talking about right now with our current system or how it would be in the future?
Not new hardware, Mr. Chairman. Let's say we change a percentage or we change rules, mm-hmm. or something about when you play. I've got some constituents that have trouble because they're bringing more people on in their payroll, but they're limited to a 3-year experience rating. That experience rating changes or something like that, how hard is it to change that in our system as far as how you calculate your premiums? Is it easy or, I mean, I know it's hard now. Is it going to be easy in the future?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, the idea is, yes, it will be easier. It will be a system that can respond because the current system we have has had no updating for many, 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 many years. So I had an employer ask me, why can't you send me an internet notice, an email, when I have a separation by an employee? Because he operates businesses in 3 counties in the state. His P.O. box is in Jackson. And so we send him a notice via mail saying you have 7 days to respond if you have an issue with this employee separating. And he's saying, well, what if I don't check my mail for 7 days? I missed my opportunity to respond. Can't you just send me an email? And I'm like, oh, I'm sure we can. That sounds great. Well, that's easy enough. Pick up the phone and call. It's like, oh, no, there's no way. I mean, the programming time to make that change to our system and what it would impact down the road as far as the way the COBOL programming works is you know, it's a big hill to climb. So the idea is we would have a system where we could go, yeah, that's great. That's something that would help employers. And we would have the technology to be able to make that change. But we're talking, I mean, this will be 3 to 4 year project, so we're in this for the long haul, but it needs to be done.
I think let's talk about the mechanics of this. You've got a change in the way your expenditure wants since the time that the governor wrote his message. And so if we just were to approve the Gov's rec, it would be as written. If we want to amend the Gov's rec, we'd have to put in a footnote or do something. So it occurs to me that the easiest thing to do is once you've settled into what you want to do, that the governor send up a governor's letter directing how you use the money with respect to this 4-state project, then we just approve the Gov's rec, and then we don't have to worry about footnotes. Does that make sense, Bill? What I'm saying is if we change the Gov's rec, then we have to put in the language how we're changing it. So if you now know how you want to administer the money, you just tell the governor sends a letter and says, this is my new recommendation, and then we just approve it, and that way it's documented in his letter.
Mr. Chairman, I'm confused why the recommendation would need to be changed.
Is the way you propose to use the funding?
Because the way the funding will be used is it will, in its entirety, be reobligated to the state of Colorado. So we just need the spending authority to be able to get it in and get it back out.
So what you're saying is that 901 series allows you to spend $58 million, and the guiding principle is the way your narrative provides in on page 66. So is the narrative on page 66 consistent with what you intend to do?
Oh, because it still says that we're acting as the lead, which is incorrect.
So if you've changed from your narrative, then you have a new request. So you would want to then have the governor issue a letter saying amending it he could be 11 on top of this, but if you don't want to go through the B11 process later, then the narrative has to be consistent with your expenditure request.
I would love to be 11 it. But the idea
but
was...
But you can't be 11 it to your own count.
Well, no, but
account.
I mean, be 11 it in and get it out. But the whole idea was that then we wouldn't have this discussion. So this is a good discussion. So
but as a practical matter, it's easier for us if you've changed than ask the governor to make a change. So we record it as we go along and we know it now. It's easier for us if you have governor issue B11. Does everybody agree? And when I get that kind of a nod from the staff, I think we're on the right track. Okay, so governor's letter directing the recharacterizing the method of utilization of the funds.
Okay.
And that will eliminate the B11, which is principally, and what I meant to say, you cannot put it in your personal account, if that's what you were thinking.
I got that part.
Mr. Chairman, maybe more of a question for you than for Ms. Evans, so I understand the process. So they're getting money from the feds, and they have to get spending authority to get it and then to shoot it back out to Colorado. But then are they going to need on top of that, as they start to build this system 3 and 4 years down the road, they'll need spending authority to get the money back from our portion of whatever we're getting from the force? They won't?
I don't think so. I mean, the principal issue is that in the end of the day, if you come to me and said, I heard that they're using the money for a four-state coal project, is that okay? We would send our staff to go back and look at the budgetary request, and that defines the limits, because when we adopt the governor's rec, the governor's rec says, I approve the funds as described and proposed in the agency's narrative. So that becomes, in a sense, the boundaries of the expenditures. So as you're reviewing and looking at this, you think in terms of the agency request being the boundaries of expenditure as modified by the Gov's Recs. We approve the Gov's Rec, but in the budget it just simply says dollar amount and there's no description. Now if we want to change the Gov's Rec, that requires a footnote. And so just a good thing to remember as we're going through. So literally if you see an agency request that you're okay with the funding but you don't like the way it's used or you don't like the narrative, then that would be a motion to amend. Does that make sense? So it's just a recognition of the significance of the narrative, and the agencies are bound to that. Once they have the amount authorized, the governor can go through the B11 process to change it, but then we'd have a record of that. So if we wanted to see if there was a record of change in it, you'd have a written record. But otherwise, the agencies are bound, and A&I then, the budget division, restricts their utilization within the boundaries set by their narratives. That makes sense? Sound right? Okay. So you'll meet with A&I and get that straightened out and make sure it's authorized the way you want to spend it. Okay. Next.
All right, next item. The $400,000 for Power Suite contract support. As you may or may not be aware of, the workers' compensation system that runs all of the data and payments for workers' compensation has been an upgrade process for the past couple of years. It will be moving off of a system we call WINGS onto a system that we call PowerSuite, and it will go live in February. And so this $400,000 request that has been recommended for denial was a maintenance contract for that system. And we're moving on. Okay. Nope. Moving on. Okay, the next item on page 81, the request for $225,710 for hardware replacements, again, associated with that new system coming on track. All right, the next item, the $23,458, again, hardware associated with the PowerSuite migration from WINGS. Next item, some...
Tell you what, just let me stop. You know, we've got the revenue code 6205. Is that the workers' comp trust fund?
Spending
authority.
You
might just explain, refresh our recollection how that works.
That portion of funding in our agency is considered to be other funds, and so we still need to have spending authority to spend those funds if they go above what the amount that has been previously approved. So that's where we are with this particular situation.
Those funds would be derived from employer contributions?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And you have trust fund's probably not the right. You have a reserve account that builds the reserve. What's that account now, too?
The workers' comp trust fund balance is, I have it right here on my little notes. It's right here. It is about $1.3 million in the trust right now. And, of course, we work with the actuaries to determine, our future liability and all of that. And our rates were just signed and put into place for the new year, and they will remain the same. No increase, no decrease.
Now, do you have actuaries that help you project to make sure that you're setting aside enough monies and things like that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That and goes a little beyond our expertise.
What do those actuarial studies tell us?
That we are solvent, we're good. That's how they take that information and they use that to determine if we need to make an adjustment in rates. And we determined this year that we would not be changing rates. There was a statutory change, I believe, last session, and so we're waiting to see how that fully impacts the fund before we make a determination in a rate change.
$1.3 million trust fund seems light to me. Is that what it is? It's
billion. With a B. Yes.
Yeah. Fund that's managed by the treasurer.
Yes.
And is that a constitutional account that allows investments in equities?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
And how have your investments been doing?
Mr. Chairman, we met with the treasurer, oh my gosh, it's been about 6 months ago, and went over the strategy that we do have a little bit of latitude set by statute within the agency to invest portions of that and vary that, and we felt comfortable with how things were doing. The investments were looking good, and it's a very conservative approach, and as far as I know, it looks fine.
Now, when we hear when the treasurer talks to you, does the treasurer talk to you as though these are part of the pool dollars that he invests, or does he describe them as a violet?
Mr. Chairman, say that again. Describe them as what?
I mean, when you hear, we hear about pooled funds that are being invested, and then we have the trust funds. Are these described as the trust funds in his description, or do you know?
It's Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding, and if you don't, may I ask Bob, our fiscal, but when I was in the meeting, my understanding he was talking about our fund.
Mr. Chairman, The funds are invested separately by the treasurer between equities, fixed income, and cash. And I can give you a balance or a status as of the end of October if you'd like to know how much is in each one. The rate of return at the end of last year was 7.48%.
Moving on to page 83, the request for $418,750 on what we call the master service agreement with the chief information officer. This encompasses several different projects. One is the Microsoft Active Directory services that will connect our two intranets together. Right now it's a bit challenging working with those separately. We have some workers' comp work done in there. We have SharePoint. We just lack the human capital and both that and the expertise to be able to work on these projects. So we're making a request of the master service agreement. The last item, again, page 84, for $225,489. Again, workers' compensation in regard to their production software. And I believe, Mr. Chairman, that wraps up the exceptions.
I can't remember where, but I added a mental note to ask you about workers' comp. Whether those rates, I mean, whether the amount of money going out has stayed the same relatively, or did it increase in the last year, those general trends?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we were able to provide you with information on the number of claimants. There was a question earlier in the week about referrals to the Office of Administrative Hearing. So we do have the claim. Number of claims being filed. As far as the dollar amounts, Bob, do you have those with you, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, as far as the workers' claim expenditures, for 2000, I'll give you an example, 2009, there were $138 million. 2010, it was $152 million. 2011, it was $161 million. But a lot of that was basically a lot of increases, probably major medical costs, medical expenses. I don't have that breakdown between the two, but it's the majority of that $160 million and $61 million in 2011. $100 million of that was in medical expenses. The rest of it would be indemnity payments, the TTD and permanent losses and that type. And if you want us to provide you any more detail, we'll be glad to do that.
Just trying to figure out some trends to figure out why it's going up, whether it's because we've got more unemployment. I'm just trying to figure out.
Sorry.
You know, it is going up. It's trending up, trying to figure out, you know, the reasons, if there's some outside external factor doing it, you know, to try to get some correlations into our unemployment or anything else that's going on with workers' comp. Changes in types of industries that are coming in, you know, is it oil and gas industry bringing them up? Is it something else bringing them up?
When it comes to the program side, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I'm going to turn that over to John Eisbart, who's the administrator of Standards and Compliance.
Thanks, Bob. Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, we've seen an impact in the cost of medical care. It has been one part, but also in 2009 legislative changes, the death benefit was raised significantly, which also has impacted the fund. And then also the temporary total disability formula was changed as well. Now it's gone.
Oh.
So we've seen the impact of those three elements. One, increase in the actual cost of Medicare. Now a regular exam costs more for everybody. death benefit and then temporary total disability.
So two of them were legislatively, and one was just general cost increases.
Right, cost of medical care, yes.
All right, thank you.
He's usually pretty entertaining, so glad keeping that up today.
Yeah, it's all yours.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Evans, the federal funds, when you talk about spending authority, that has to be both legislatively and executive branch. Do we both have to agree, or can the governor just make a recommendation to the legislature? Are there different types of federal funds that you get?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, yes, we get a variety of different sources of federal funds, and so we usually base our request on what the past appropriation has been for our state, which that can change. Right now we're monitoring a potential very crippling decrease in Workforce Investment Act funds that, if that comes to fruition, could be very damaging to our local offices. So, you know, we know from biennium to biennium what we got last time and what the guidance letters from the federal programs say that we will get. And so that's where we have to have that spending authority within our budget to be able to bring that money in and then go ahead and spend it back out, which accounts for about 46% of our overall total budget.
And follow up, Mr. Chairman, so like last year, in the middle of a legislative session, or maybe when we're not even in session, and Congress passes legislation to extend unemployment benefits, and last year we had to have the bill that came forward for us to allow you to access that $35 million, which unfortunately didn't pass. Is there any other avenues of recourse that your department can take then to access those funds, extend those benefits?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Esquel, that was in specifically toward changing the eligibility requirements, if I believe, if I'm thinking back correctly. So that wasn't just a matter of accessing that money and bringing in and paying current claimants or people that were on continuing claims or extended benefits. That would have changed who we could make eligible. And so because that wasn't changed at the state level, we were not able to accept those federal funds.
And Mr. Chair, what are we doing now to change those eligibility requirements? Anything?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, nothing. I will say, Mr. Chairman and Representative Escobel, that if a federal program had a change and they said we would be able to give you, say, let's use Workforce Investment Act as an example. That means we would be able to, if they, the U.S. Department of Labor said, you know, we're going to have $5 million available for Wyoming additional this year so that you could train more people, give more supportive services, we could then come to the governor's office and ask to B11 those funds in and do a NAFR and say, those were unanticipated funds coming in. This is specifically what they would be used for. Unless we get the spending authority, we can't use them. And so they would have the discretion at that point to make a decision on those funds. Something unexpected that comes up between budget cycles.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in that case, it seemed it came to us at the 11th hour, and there was a lot of misunderstandings, I think, about what those funds were actually able to do for the state of Wyoming. So, I guess that's part of the problems we have with having such a short session, having a citizens legislature like we do, also having so much turnover in the legislature. You know, not everybody's really versed on how federal funds work and how some of that legislation's impacted the state and the citizens. So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I understood the issues. There were additional funds made available by Congress to extend the length of employment benefits. unemployment business. That was that the topic we're talking about, or are we talking?
Mr. Chairman, it was making money available to states who were willing to change their eligibility requirements. So changing, I think it looked at veterans.
Veterans and a woman who.
I'm trying to think. I can't quite remember what the potential change was, but it. Oh, displaced, dislocated workers. There were three areas that basically folks could not use that particular status to be eligible for unemployment insurance benefits, but the statutory change would have made a whole new group of people eligible to receive benefits that had not been eligible to receive benefits in the past. So that bill was worked through a committee that I don't think it passed out of committee, if I remember right. And so then we were not eligible to tap into that money.
All right. So in that sense, is where the statutory, the legislature has to set the statutory authority for folks to qualify. If the legislature adopts that, then the federal funds come to supply the benefits, or do you end up adjusting your there's no state fund on that, so that's all paid by federal contribution?
That, Mr. Chairman, that particular situation would have been, yes.
That's something that was time limited for funding, or was that something that would go on and on so that, I mean, is there any reason why if the state were to choose to, they could not become eligible now by changing, or was there a window that's now gone?
Mr. Chairman, there was a window that's now gone.
That discussion is no longer relevant. It's not on the table.
Right. Mr. Chairman,
right.
You're right.
How about length of time for employment? I mean, is that a state-by-state issue or is that a federal issue with respect to the amount of time you can stay eligible to continuing take or receiving payments?
Mr. Chairman, that is a state-by-state.
Once again, is that an option that where are we compared to what's available as options?
Mr. Chairman, right now an initial claim will go for 26 weeks, and then someone can go on a continuing claim for another 26 weeks. Previously, there was an extension granted that was up to 99 weeks that the U.S. Department of Labor called Tier 3, but they have eliminated Tier 3 now. So anybody that's on there will run that time out, but if you hadn't already applied for Tier 3 benefits, you cannot get on to that. So it's a rather complex system depending on the individual and whether they meet the requirements and if they're continuing their work searches and continuing all the things that they have to be ready and available for work and all of those kinds of things. And if you recall, last time I was here having a conversation with you, I got a good question from Representative Harshman about an individual he knew that he thought shouldn't be getting unemployment insurance benefits, and we followed up on that. And that's a big part of the partnership that we want to have with business and constituents, that if you know of someone taking advantage of the system, you can let us know and we can sure look into that, because it's not always caught just within our own system.
Harshman the narc. You can narc somebody out. So now, as a practical matter, we have statutory benefits that mirror what's eligible or available at the federal level or federal funding?
Mr. Chairman, Lisa might be able to explain this better. Like, the extensions are granted on what your state unemployment rate is. So if you drop below a certain rate, because we have relatively low unemployment here in Wyoming compared to other states, that's why, like, the Tier 3 option for 99 weeks of eligibility went away. So it's tied to a formula. So it mirrors other states in the sense that we're part of a big picture, and we're compared to other states, and depending on what the unemployment rate is, our status may or may not change. Did I get
Fair
that
enough.
Right?
I think what I want to follow up really is that if Representative Esquivel is really saying, look, are there more benefits that we could offer if we choose to by changing our statutes that would soften the impact for those that are unemployed, or are we pretty much sitting where we can be?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding that those options are no longer available. As Director Evans was explaining, you know, some legislation came. We had an opportunity to maybe possibly change some legislation that would allow us to change our benefits. but that did not pass out of committee. And because our unemployment rate is lower compared to most states, we are no longer able to offer that Tier 3 extended benefits. Many states are still offering that, Mr. Chairman.
Even if we wanted to, we wouldn't qualify.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe there's any other opportunities, but I will be sure to look into it.
Mr. Chairman, well, I guess the way I interpreted the chairman's question, and maybe I misunderstood what he was asking too, but is there a way, though, I guess, and maybe I'll just ask my own question then, is how does our, if each state sets the amount of benefits for the term, you know, if we're 26 weeks and then we can go, can we change that if statutorily?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, it's a federal formula that is determined how that is set. So I don't believe that can be changed at the state level, but maybe I'm not understanding the question.
Well, my question is that if in the state statutes dictate how long you provide, we provide unemployment benefits, isn't that something we could change?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, we'll have to look. I don't think it's in state statute, the 26 weeks, 52 weeks. That's a federal model that's applied to the state based on our current situation. What we can do in statute is outline eligibility requirements, and that's what was up for discussion last session. I can double check, but it's not my understanding that maybe there's another expert in the room that can jump in on that, but we can look for you. It's not my understanding that those weeks are set.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I misunderstood what you said, because I thought you had said that it's up to the states, each individual state, to define benefits for the state, and that piece that Representative Esquivel was speaking to was an exception, you know, a one-time exception to get people through a tough time.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, it varies state to state, depending on your unemployment rate and how you fit into the funding model, the eligibility or the, you know, the weeks and how they lay all that out.
Mr. Chairman, and, you know, just for clarification for the future, that should those windows of opportunity open up again, that we as a legislature are a little more versed in that issue and how that actually comes about, how it works, and how we're able to implement those changes in order to help the citizens of the state of Wyoming.
You know, I guess there's, I'll be right with you, I guess there'd be one issue, and that is if funds were made available and there was, could the governor himself B11 the funds, that's a different question. They'd have to go to his own staff to see whether he could B11. If the governor does not B11 the funds, then the only way for the agency to access it would be through legislative initiative, which means we'd have to have a session to do that. And so I think probably the question of whether or not the governor could B11 funds that were not provided for by statute and then make a program available to Wyoming students or constituents, that's an issue that I suspect that, John, you're probably not an expert on, but that is a different issue.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a different issue. And again, this was very specific and brought forward by a legislator who felt like it would help a specific contingency. And I think it really boils down to the will of the body. I mean, what is our goal? And, you know, I'd like to focus on reemployment. So instead of keeping folks on benefits, getting them back into the system and working on efficiencies within the agency to cause that to happen rather than extending a benefit situation. But, you know, it depends on how it's written. It depends on the will. And, again, that went to a committee and the decision was made there. That was not a situation where that money could have been B11 in without a statutory change.
Okay.
And it wasn't something the agency brought. It was a legislator that had a concern regarding constituents.
Go ahead and let's not argue about the program.
Okay. The question I'd have is that on those changes in eligibility standards, were the eligibility standards, I believe, were going to remain effective after the federal money left the system. So it's kind of like if you're in the Medicaid system and the federal government said, here's a whole bunch of money, but you have to do transplants for everybody. But if the money goes away, you still have to do transplants. Is that kind of an analogy?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that was a point of concern.
Mr. Chairman, I guess if we're on any portion of this, I just wanted to talk about the workers' comp division a little bit, and I had some, concerns. Just wanted to talk about, kind of make maybe the divisions. I know you're new with this, so we have a new director here. Kind of get an idea of what the philosophy is. We discussed a little bit about the changes in the statutes a couple years ago, and that I had spent a lot of time personally going around the state with several organizations talking about issues people in Wyoming are facing, and I am personally getting calls from constituents with concerns about the comp division and, denial of claims and, and I kind of like to just get a handle on some of the, if there's, what the philosophy is and, a little bit of detail of how that's going, the amount of money we have presently in the fund and how that's going, even with the increases that we've made with the comp division, I guess would want to get into some, specifics or just, like what's the case, I guess if we want to get into specific questions, like what's the caseload right now compared to what it was, what's the percentage of cases that are denied by the division or and I guess I'd like to know what constitutes a denial from the division as opposed to denial from an employer, and what the percentage of fraud you're seeing out there is.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hester, that's about 12 questions in a row, so I'll try to track at least the first couple. I can tell you that since the reorganization started, really last March after the bill was signed, there's been a basic retooling of the workers' comp division. First of all, customer service, the way that we treat people and respond to people. The bar was set pretty high that we needed to make some internal modifications there. If you have constituents that are concerned, please give Lisa and I a chance to look at them individually. I would just encourage you to do that. We've looked at many, many, many over the past year. We were having a legislator brought forward some specific concerns to us in one area of the state, which actually brought about a change in the way the chiropractic board, right, John, was made up. We had some individuals who'd been on this thing for 25 years or something like that. So we're really trying to take apart what's working, what's not. As far as talking about individual denial, what constitutes a denial, what constitutes that, I mean, John might be able to speak a little bit more. I mean, those are so case by case. It's hard to give you just an overall general philosophy. John's held what we've called an annual meeting with all of his staff to talk about system improvements. One of the questions that I think that you guys had earlier in the week was from the Office of Administrative Hearings talking about dealing with workers' comp appeals. And one of the things that we just put in place 6 weeks ago is that we have an internal review process that's now been streamlined where an analyst used to have to go to a district manager and one other person and then an administrator to determine whether they were going to deny something, which could then potentially cause an appeal. Because in statute, a claimant and a physician, anybody can appeal everything. So every single bill, every single act, everything that's going on. So you can see how that really mounts up. Well, right now, over the past 6 weeks, we've tried a new system where that analyst takes it directly to Steve Schottsky, who was formerly the administrator over the agency, but or the division, and they work more comprehensively before that gets to hearing. So making some better decisions so that we're not sending so many cases to hearing. So we're down 50% over the past 6 weeks in the number of cases that we're referring to OAH, which lowers their costs. And that was a recommendation and a brainstorming that came from our staff during that opportunity to sit down at an annual meeting. So I don't know, Mr. Chairman, would you like to hear more from John in regard to some of the questions that Senator Hastert had?
Wanted, and if you want to know how the statutes work, then I think that's something you do one-on-one. But if you want to learn about philosophies and what's going on, this is the time to do it. So just be judicious. Remember, Rosie wants to go home today.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, speaking to the appeals and denial of claims that you spoke about, one of the things that we've identified and have resolved is that at the claims analyst, when they request the medical records from the physicians, some of them don't always get those records in a expeditious way. And so the claims analysts were taking an easy approach and just denying the claim, saying we don't have the medical records to prove that it's work-related or work-connected injury. Now what we do is we have them then call the physician's office multiple times to say we really need them, instead of forcing that decision through the appeals section. It's quicker and it's much cheaper for all of them. As Director Evans said, the focus of the annual meeting was customer service. And it's when we look at customers, we have employer customers, we have provider customers, and then we have the injured worker as customers. And so we really have a neutral approach to all three of those until the injury has been accepted. When we accept liability for that, then we do become a patient advocate or an injured worker advocate. And so it's getting that culture spread throughout the agency is where we're at now.
Mr. Chairman, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I think I'm going to hold off, and I have some other routes of questioning that I think I'm going to do one-on-one with the director.
You think it's information that we all need to have at, if it's something that you just think that's of interest just to you, then I'd encourage you to do that, but I don't want to discourage you from asking questions that that you think that will teach us about the system that we need to know for budgetary purposes.
Well, Mr. Chairman, some of the areas that I wanted to kind of broach in on, you know, is the it has to do with workers' comp, and I don't always understand how an injury gets classified, or then how an injury, if someone's injured on the job, and then one of the things that we heard when I went around the state is that, you know, I injured my knee at work, and then the next thing I know, I'm being told it was a degenerative thing, so it's all denied. And I don't understand. I still don't understand how that happens.
Well, again, I don't want to discourage doing that. I'm not sure how that's going to help us make a decision on the budget. I can answer those questions, but I practice in this area. I represent employers, and I know what's going on. But I think that's something I prefer that you talk, because I'm not sure it's going to give us any insight on the budget. If it was something that was going to save money, or you think that their purses are too tight. And then there's also the Oversight Committee, Labor, which really is responsible for that. So I think that's something, if you're willing, do it later, and then we'll turn. Anybody else have questions? If not, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Thank you for giving up your lunchtime. I hope you don't starve to death.
There's probably chocolate cake in the break room.
No, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, Mr. Vercel, and for all the you that don't know, as Mike was down with Mike McVeigh last week golfing, and
he sends his good wishes.
I bet.
Yeah, I'll bet. I'll bet it was his good wishes. It was. All right, Mr. Vercel, just take us through your budget.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and Committee. My name is Mike Vercel. I'm the Director of the Wyoming Water Development Program. With me today, I have Andrea Odell. She is our Fiscal Control Officer, but in a small agency, she is also our Human Resources Expert. She is our liaison with the Auditor's Office, and I've even seen her sweep out the place a couple times. So she is our jack of all trades. If you will, I'll start off just briefly about what we do. I'm going to talk from page 4 of the budget, but we are a program who's invests in water projects, dams, reservoirs, pipelines, diversion dams. Basically, the state's water infrastructure. We have a new development program that we use to construct new and expand existing projects. We have a rehabilitation program, which we use to invest to upgrade our existing infrastructure. That's our rehabilitation program. We also have a dam and reservoir program whereby we are seeking to construct dams with a capacity of 10,000 acre foot or more, or enlarge dams as much as 5,000 acre feet. We are also the state's water planning agency. We do that through the development and an updating of 7 basin-wide plans. Then based on those plans, we can identify water supply needs. We also have watershed studies, whereby a group of water users can come to us to concentrate particularly on storage opportunities and water management opportunities in a particular watershed. Getting to our... Oh, one other thing that we do that is getting more important all the time. We are the manager of the state's investment in water. We are the agency that manages the state's holdings in Buffalo Bill, Fontenelle, Palisades Reservoir on the Idaho state line. Recently, we have just completed, or at the end of the year, we'll have completed the Pathfinder Modification Project. We have the High Savory Project over by Bags. Very soon we will complete a contract to acquire water in Glendale Reservoir under a long-term contract. And we are obtaining that water to meet some of our obligations under the Nebraska v. Wyoming lawsuit. So that is also an important element of our duties. Getting to our budget, Mr. Chairman, I've provided a handout that basically is it's entitled Wyoming Water Development Office Budget Summary, and I do this because your book confuses me, and I need one sheet to in fact talk from. What I have here is a breakdown of the series, what we actually were budgeted in 11 and 12. The initial application applied or standard budget, if you will, as it came from DAI, Budget Division. And then some of the changes that we proposed to our budget when... those of us that were fortunate enough to get appointed to the cabinet, we signed an oath with Governor Mead, and he reminded us that part of that oath was to look at our budget for potential savings. And so we, in fact, did that. If you look down under 900 series, We've done that in two ways. Initially, we had a budget item for in-stream flow feasibility studies, water-related research. Basically, what that is if the commission or select water committee have a specific issue that they would like to see us perform additional analysis, we can. And then we had some additional money to support our basin-wide planning. We decided that if we could just get one budget item with the flexibility to do all three of these tasks, there would be a cost savings involved. And so we're proposing a $125,000 cut in that budget item. The other item has to do with our relationship with the Water Resources Data System at the University of Wyoming. We basically fund that agency. And that is the agency that takes care of our library. It does all our GIS work. It makes sure that our water plans are available to the public for inspection and review, as well as all our project reports. Prior to this budget, we had a full-time director that served two hats, if you will, the state climatologist as well as the director of WERDS. That gentleman resigned. And so this particular budget just proposes that we have a part-time director from a faculty member at the University of Wyoming. And then if other entities feel that they need a state climatologist, that would be up to them to, in fact, seek that funding. It got to be a position where we were responsible for the funding, but we weren't responsible or have input into the operation of the state climatologist, which got a little strange from time to time. So we think this is a better operation, and it will result in a budget reduction. We have a number on this piece of page that if it should be decided by the decision makers that we should fund a state climatologist, you would need to hire $107,117 to the budget. We would hope that you don't do that, but there's the numbers if you need it. The last column is the governor accepted our exception budgets, as well as with everyone else, there was a reduction in our 400 series. So we come today before you to request a budget of $8,052,902. I would point out these funds come from Water Development Account 1. We do not receive any general fund monies.
I guess we should talk about the governor's it's at 16 of the budget, but he's recommending that you take what would be the imputed interest off of Water 3, $9,488,818, and transfer it to Water 2. Are there specific projects you had in mind for that, or was he just wanting to supplement the available funding in Water 2?
Mr. Chairman, I have a handout that's called Water Development Accounts Financial Summary. And basically what it is just a shifting of the funds from 3 to 2. As I've testified to you before on rehabilitation projects, typically the primary benefactor of our rehabilitation program is irrigation districts. Our existing irrigation infrastructure is in oftentimes 100 years old. We do master plans with irrigation districts where we do an inventory and try to prioritize those improvements that do need to be done right away. And then next step, projects that would improve efficiency and reduction in operation and maintenance costs. But we have been, we don't have enough financial resources to do everything that needs to be done. So what we do is every year we come in and look at the irrigation district's needs, and we tell them because of our cash flow problems, we can only provide funding for a two-year program, if you will. Well, we have been doing this for a number of years, and what is happening, at least right now, that made me request a one-time infusion of funds, is this is starting to catch up with us. if we could get this one-time infusion of funds, it would get us back on top of the work that we're doing with these irrigation districts. This is not a long-term commitment. It is just a one-time transfer, if you will, from account 3 to 2 to allow us to catch up with the work we're doing with irrigation districts. The dollar amount, the 94488318, is simply, it was selected by the governor because it is the amount of interest that we received on water development account 3 in 2011 or 2000.
Now, for these are part of the pool fund investments of the agency pool?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Each of these accounts are interest-bearing accounts that we enjoy, if you will. These accounts receive the mineral royalties income by the formulas. They're capped just like all other mineral royalty income. And then we enjoy the interest on the income in that account. Plus, we enjoy the payments on the loans that we make out of these accounts. And in addition, which makes us very efficient, we also enjoy the reversions from project appropriations that are unexpended. So, if you will, on that same handout, and I've given you this before, we have a complete status report for you of account 1, 2, and 3. Now, this is a historic document. This includes all the transactions that occurred, if you will, since these accounts were established back in the late 70s and the 80s. So for water development account 1, you can see the revenues that we've enjoyed either from direct appropriations for the general fund, taxes, if you will, loans, interest. In any event, this is what we use as our planning tool at the beginning of each biennium to decide how much money we have to allocate to projects. I won't go through this ad nauseum, but I would suggest to you that when you look at when we're looking at anticipated revenues in future years, I want to assure you that we are conservative. We don't want to get in a situation where we're overestimating interest income or the amount of income that we are in fact getting from payments. So. But right now, for this upcoming biennium, and we're presently in the business of allocating funds to projects, in Water Development Account 1, we have $72.4 million available for us for the next 2 years. Account 2, we have $14.8 million. And account 3 is $126.1 million.
With respect to account 3, it's generally been our desire to build that account for larger projects, and we usually have members that are pushing to continue to add to that account. So it's a little concerning that we're now taking away from the account into water 2 at a time when really our finances aren't that bleak. When you look out in the horizon, what are the kinds of projects that will be called upon to fund with Water 3 and, you know, and on your horizon, on your landscape?
Right. Water Account 3, the monies that stay in that account, they're specifically allocated by statutes to dams and reservoirs. The business of dams and reservoirs has got more difficult. We're not going to build new Buffalo Bill dams and do some of the major things that we would like to do. We have about 8 to 10 candidates for projects that would be in the neighborhood of, High Savory. sort of things, 10 to 30,000 acre foot projects based on, and they typically would be located on tributaries rather than main stem of the Green River or of the Platte or of the Bighorn River. And these candidates have flown, if you will, out of watershed plans typically. We're looking up around the Knowwood River. We're looking in the Shell Valley area, Sheridan, etc. I would say that typically these things are going to cost about $30 to $35 million apiece. And they're not going to all happen at the same time. If we're having a problem right now, it is generating, if you will, the partnership we need with the water users. This is tough business building dams, and they need to be in lockstep with us or we're not going to be successful. But I think that's coming, and I think you will see this program hopefully be coming to you in the near future for a small dam, and hopefully we would get started doing that every year or two. And again, Mike Besson, the former director, is now the head of our Dam and Reservoir Division. They are working, testing the technical feasibility of these. That means the hydrology, the foundation of the dams, coming up with operations that are both water effective and environmentally responsible, and then using that information to try to garner interest with the sponsors. The Select Water Committee and Water Development Commission have basically said on dams and reservoirs that if we could get with these partners, we would be comfortable in recommending to the legislature very favorable financial terms, just because of the indirect benefits to the state of having storage. So that's where we are. Your guess is as good as mine. If I put a cash flow to it, I would say we could use this money over the next 5 to 10 years.
I think in terms of what we need to begin, what kind of a budget we're working towards, if we take, I mean, you said 13 projects, if half of them come to fruition and each one of those is $30 million, you're talking about $180, $200 million.
That would be my estimate, yes. I'm also comfortable with the fact that this body and the legislature in particular, if we come up with a good storage project, I am assured that this legislature, as much as the group as a whole, favors storage, that we will find a way to get it funded.
I guess, could you give us sort of a spreadsheet on the projects that are under investigation and get some swags on amounts to show, look, could be your potential investment? You know, we're called upon to answer the question, what are we going to do? Why are we building this account? What are appropriate targets? And if, flip side of it, if we're going to deplete the accounts, what is it? What's the dream that we're giving up? So I know that you're not a person that likes to put out numbers that our estimates, but we need to have something to say, look, give us a range or whatever, but give us number of projects, ranges. If you think that there's a time frame on it that you can estimate it, even if it's wishful thinking, but at least let's put together a picture of what your mind's eye sees as the vision going forward so we know what we're saving for.
Mr. Chairman, very good. We'd be happy to do that, just with the understanding that on some of the projects we have a very good estimate. Sometimes it's going to be a wag, but we can give you ballpark numbers.
Mike, going back to the stage or the number two category, when I was on Ag a few years ago, we had an estimate on what it would take if you were going to just write a check for all of the deferred maintenance and all of the problems that we have in these irrigation projects across the state. And I recall it was somewhere around $900 million. If, you know, you've got concrete that's 50 years old and breaking out and you know, just structures that, you know, concrete only lasts so many years, and most of these things are made out of concrete. And at some point in time, even though we're keeping up with, you know, the the emergency things here, and this $9 million will get us back into keeping up with those. Any updated stuff that where we know where we're going to get a huge increase in some of these needs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think your $900,000 is close, $900 million. But you know, I am comfortable with the program that we have right now, where we're working on 2-year increments. Because how we're doing this typically is we're giving grants for materials. The irrigation districts are using their personnel to keep them busy over the winter. They're using their equipment that allows them to maintain that manpower over the winter. There's just, in some cases, there's just so much that they can do. So this is working good. The issue, Mr. Chairman and committee, we brought this issue, if you will, to Joint Ag. And it was their recommendation that there be a $10 million infusion of funds into account too. And that was, in part based on my request and their understanding of what we're facing in demands on that account. Governor Meade was good enough to accommodate that request.
Mr. Purcell, the number that represents the interest is that going to be sufficient, or is that, I guess, might turn the question around, the projects that you know you're going to be working on? My understanding is this is just a kind of a one-time deal, that you don't anticipate that you would need to continue it in the future or not. How far is this going to get us to fixing the problem and getting caught up with those back projects is what my question is.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, we're going to use this money gradually. Okay, we get $6 million income over 2 years. I don't want to spend this next year. I want to, every year we can add a little more, because typically what we do if we have $6 million or whatever, $14 million in this case, let's say $7 million a year. This year we're actually asking for more than $7 million. So it's just to help us continue to maintain an aggressive approach on the rehabilitation. I'm not suggesting to you that next year you're going to see a whole $9 million more in the rehabilitation program. But it would be a one-time fund, influx of funds for us to be allowed to plan on in every subsequent session for a period of 3 to 4 years. And that will let us, over that 3 to 4 year time period, be more aggressive and be more helpful, if you will, on these rehabilitation of the ag facilities. And there are some municipal projects out there as well. That is the concept.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director, so do you have projects in the track ready to go with this, or do you envision having to start a lot of them through your Level 1, Level 2 studies to spend that money?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stewart, these are already projects that we have identified and are awaiting the opportunity to construct. These are not, they're not waiting for a study. We have done master plans. I'm going to forget somebody for the 5 districts up in Park, Bighorn County, Grable Valley, Sublet Creek, Green River, Wheatland, Goshen. We have a portfolio of about 20 districts that we're working with. And they come in every other year. I've got them broken out, so many of them come in on the first year of the biennium. Some come in on the second year of the biennium, and they come in with their wish list, and I say, I cut them back. I say, no, we can only go this far, given our financial constraints. this money will allow us to be a little more aggressive, gets a little more money in the economy, and solve the problem a little quicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not so much follow-up, but I asked the director of Oil and Gas Commission the other day about his potential role in the governor's initiative, partnerships, if you will, for the water quality issues up in Pavilion, and you are also on that short list of partnerships. And if you foresee a financial responsibility there in that going forward, and also talk about some of your efforts in finding a solution. I know we did a study a year or two ago to look at that issue there in Pavilion. Thank you.
I want to be, Mr. Chairman, I want to be very careful here because we do have two hats. And our first hat, we were invited in understanding that there were citizens in Wyoming up there that had bad water quality. They were the bad drinking water. And this is what we do. This, we have done rural water systems all over the state. Gillette, Bighorn Basin. And so we were invited in to, if you will, look at the possibilities of getting a better water supply up in the Pavilion area. Now, I want to tell you, there's a reason that we do this in Wyoming. And Pavilion is a prime example. While we have abundant surface water in good years, and we have groundwater resources, oftentimes it is of poor water quality. That's why we do things like the Shoshone Regional Project. That is why we do things like the Sheridan Area Water Supply Project. That's why we do Casper Area, to make a centralized system that... are you telling secrets? Oh. Casper, town of Freudian slip, Senator Nicholas. And Pavilion, unfortunately, is located right in the middle of an area that has naturally occurring bad groundwater. We are now in the midst, if you will, of EPA studies. And we are fortunate on our staff. We have a very good groundwater geologist that has done a lot of work on how you drill monitoring wells and test those wells. And we are assisting, if you will, Mr. Dahl and Mr. Cora in the reviewing of those EPA reports. And how do I put this diplomatically? I would be embarrassed to put our name on any such reports. They are poorly written. The data that was developed is not a done. It was an EPA report, and they didn't even use their own water quality monitoring standards. So we are two-headed here. We are available to assist Wyoming citizens get better water, and we're being technical advisors, if you will, to Mr. Dahl and Mr. Cora.
Mr. Chairman, is this time to ask just about one of his expenses? And his, there's Mr. Purcell. There's like $769,000 space rental. What do you rent with that? What do you pay for with that?
Mr. Chairman, that budget comes specifically from Department of Administration and Information. We lease a building out on Yellowtail, and DIA negotiates those lease agreements, and they insert that amount of money in our standard budget. And it's a very nice building. You should come and visit us. We are living in the lap of luxury
and don't mess with it. Oh, did I say that out loud?
Mr. Chairman, I was told not to ask stupid questions, so I'm trying not to here. You're a small agency. I'm just, what else is in there? What's in the building?
Mr. Chairman, we take the top floor and about 25% of the bottom floor with our 26 employees. We have the licensing board for engineers and surveyors downstairs, and we also have a conference room that we make available throughout state government. Right. Mr. Chairman, yes.
Thank you.
There is a couple other items, if I might, Mr. Chairman. You'll note it. We do have a budget item related to the Gillette Madison project, and I have provided you a handout. It's entitled Gillette Madison Pipeline Project. I'm sure that all of you have seen this before. It's just updated, if you will. You see in the statute 99.3.1405 requested that the governor provide a recommendation for funding for $30 million for the 2012 legislature. He has done that in the form of a request of $6,975,000 from the general fund and $23,025,000 from AML for the total of $30 million. So I've updated the sheet that I've provided you historically to give you an idea of where we are with the funding of the project. I would point out that 99.3.1405 was crafted last year, I think, in part by this committee, such that we will not need an amendment on the bill if this amount is improved in our budget. So you will not be seeing, if you will, a Gillette Madison pipeline project separate piece of legislation, but the funding that you would grant under our budget would automatically feed into the authorizations provided by that project specific legislation.
Are we funding this at a rate fast enough to accomplish the desired goal?
Mr. Chairman, progress has lagged a little, but we are going to put two segments of the pipeline out for bid shortly. The drilling process has begun. If there has been a delay in part at this day and age, and it's one that's not specific to this project, it is easements. It is getting very difficult, if you will, to get easements, particularly for pipeline projects and projects in general. And so if we hit a snag in schedule, typically you can point to land acquisition. And the permitting issues here, typically permitting can be a problem, but there's not major issues here related to permitting.
Mr. Director, you mentioned earlier dams and reservoirs, or account three specifically for dams and reservoirs. And, of course, I see here we took some money out of account three for the Gillette-Madison pipeline. Could you remind me how did that exist outside of the authorization, or how did we go about doing that?
Mr. Chairman, you did that in a separate piece of legislation in an amendment to 99.3.1405. And in that amendment, and it's my job to remind you of this, that you said you would pay it back when you got flush.
Mr. Director, thank you for reminding us of that.
I think the only thing we were instructed to bring is employees. That was attached at the back of the first handout. The last 10 years, we've gone from 18 employees to 26 employees. Those were based in part by funding for staffing for the new Dams and Reservoirs Division
that was authorized about that time, as well as there was one at-will employee that was moved to permanent to manage what we call our small water program, our small water project program. So those are the reasons for our increase in staff over the 10 years. You also ask about our 900 series funding. This last year, this last biennium, that was related mostly to our obligations to the University of Wyoming as well as in-stream flows. Typically, we also spend this 900 series money that on issues. We spent some of it, if you will, on the first phase of the pavilion study. We have used it to analyze technical issues in Rawlins related to a pond. So these are things that show up, if you will, throughout a year that we don't have specific appropriations for, but the commission can use those funds to help us with gnarly issues that start up while the legislature is not in session to give us project appropriations. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I've said everything I've come to say.
May I ask him to say something else? Okay. In the budget book, it calls it the Campbell County Madison Water Project. The governor is generic enough in his recommendation that he says pursuant to the session law, which then calls it the Gillette-Madison Project, I believe. Do we have to do we have to reconcile any of that language?
The Goldenrod, there's an actual specification for the name.
It's called Campbell County.
What I'm going to ask is the staff get that the accurate. What's the name?
Mr. Chairman, the name is Gillette Madison Pipeline Account. It says Gillette Madison Pipeline Account.
Okay, the book still has the old wording we talked about last year, which said Campbell County.
Mr. Chairman, I'd feel better if you did, because the authorizations I have are in a bill talked about Gillette Madison Pipeline Project. Thank you for your time and attention, and Merry Christmas.